Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin on this 4th of July with a conversation on the meaning of patriotism and the possibility that a deeper form of patriotism is required to protect and defend planet Earth that is threatened by climate change from global warming. Robert Jensen, a professor in the School of Journalism at the University of Texas and author of Arguing for Our Lives, A User's Guide to Constructive Dialogue, joins us. He has an article at Yes Magazine, Get Apocalyptic, Why Radical is the New Normal. Then we will speak with George Lakoff, professor of cognitive science and linguistics at UC Berkeley and author of Don't Think of an Elephant. We will discuss the usurpation of patriotism by the right wing in America and whether qualities other than militarism, chauvinism, and jingoism can be celebrated on the 4th of July, such as empathy, community, charity, and generosity. Then finally, we will speak with a government whistleblower, Peter Van Buren, a veteran Foreign Service officer who wrote about the Iraq reconstruction fiasco in We Meant Well, How I Helped Lose the Battle for Hearts and Minds of the Iraqi People. He was subsequently stripped of his security clearance and diplomatic credentials by the State Department. We will discuss what the Founding Fathers meant by patriotism and how much today's government is acting like Imperial Britain in stifling dissent. And joining us now is Robert Jensen, a professor in the School of Journalism at the University of Texas at Austin and a board member of the Third Coast Activist Resource Center in Austin. He's the author of All My Bones Shake, Seeking a Progressive Path to the Prophetic Voice, Citizens of the Empire, The Struggle to Claim Our Humanity, Writing Dissent, Taking Radical Ideas from the Margins to the Mainstream, and Arguing for Our Lives, A User's Guide to Constructive Dialogue. He has an article in the current issue of Yes Magazine, Get Apocalyptic, Why Radical is the New Normal. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Jensen.
Great to be with you, Ian.
And on this 4th of July, where people in this country celebrate patriotism, it's a wonderful American holiday. People have picnics and they watch fireworks and they celebrate all of what is good about America. But it's largely dominated by jingoism and flag waving. And patriotism in this country has essentially been usurped by the right wing, even though an icon of the right like John Wayne never actually fought for this country. And also, to some extent, the Bible itself has been also confiscated by conservatives in this country. So you have a twofer. Both the Bible and patriotism seems to be the province of the right. And people on the left in this country, as Sarah Palin would say, are un-American, and even Michelle Bachmann would even take it further. So is there an alternative to right-wing patriotism in America?
Well, I think a basic question is, why should we be patriotic? That is, if patriotism is defined as love of and loyalty to your country, there's a very profound question. Why should my highest loyalty and love be attached to my country? Maybe it should be attached to all the world or to other forms of organizing ourselves. But let's say we're going to take patriotism as a potential good. There are, of course, ways to usurp the way that the right wing has attached themselves to patriotism. One is, of course, by being a citizen in the highest form, which is asking critical questions, dissenting from abuses of power. The anti-war movement has long argued that peace is patriotic, that by rejecting wars, especially wars of conquest, wars of imperialism, that one is being patriotic. So I think we can fuss about whether patriotism is all that good of an idea in the first place. But once we accept that it's a common political value, then the question isn't, are we patriotic? It's, how do we display that? And the right wing is in a kind of perverse way often the least patriotic by, for instance, valuing concentrated wealth and power over democracy.
Well, indeed. And the hollow, hypocritical nature of the political right is displayed in this immigration bill, where you had essentially, and this is the way politics seem to work in this country, that bipartisanship is in fact the liberals surrendering and the goalposts getting moved to the right, because the liberal senators, in order to get this deal, had to allow a bill to go from $8 billion to $40 billion in pork and boondoggles to secure the border. So all of the hawks on the political right who basically are just throwing money at a non-existent problem. And the money, of course, will go to the military-industrial complex, and then the border will be militarized but no more secure. And this will be a profound waste of money, but it certainly doesn't affect the deficit hawks.
Yeah. Well, this is I think the immigration issue is a great place where you see how liberal versus conservative politics in the United States is so just a bad frame. So you've got on the right, among conservatives, you have the kind of corporate business right, which has no problems with opening up immigration. They need the labor, and they're willing to go along with most any deal that allows them to the degree possible, exploit cheap labor from outside the United States. Now, the more reactionary jingoistic right, which is got its own constituency, of course, is obsessed with border security and illegal aliens, as they love to say. And so the kind of corporate right is willing to let the reactionary right have their insanity. Meanwhile, as you're pointing out, the moderate and liberal wing of the American mainstream, mostly in the Democratic Party, doesn't really have a principled defense of an open border policy. And so they get pushed around and end up signing on to a really ridiculous bill, as you're pointing out. The answer to immigration questions, everyone understands, isn't a fence and isn't more cops on the beat. It's not border security that's at issue. It's border fairness, which means economic fairness, which means economic justice, which means trade policies that don't further impoverish parts of the third world. It means economic policy that provides for American workers fair wages and decent treatment. And that's what we don't have. And so the immigration issue is probably one of the most ridiculous debates that's been going on in the last 10, 20 years. And we see it in this, as you're pointing out, absurd so-called compromise bill that we got.
And again, I'm speaking with Robert Jensen, professor in the School of Journalism at the University of Texas at Austin and board member of the Third Coast Activist Resource Center in Austin, and the author of Writing Dissent, Taking Radical Ideas from the Margins to the Mainstream and Arguing for Our Lives, A User's Guide to Constructive Dialogue. He has an article in the current issue of Yes Magazine, Get Apocalyptic, Why Radical is the New Normal. Now, you're turning around the apocalyptic notion that has been expropriated by the Christian right. The Book of Revelation, which of course is largely incomprehensible, has become a fundraising tool for evangelicals. The biggest, I think one of the best sellers in the world, are these Left Behind series. And there's a kind of spiritual pornography associated with the way that these preachers and these believers in the apocalypse talk about the lakes of fire and sea of blood. And essentially what they're saying is that my world has to end in burning flesh in order for their world to begin. And I take it you feel there's a way to expropriate that kind of spiritual pornography and use the notion of apocalypse in a positive way.
Right. You're pointing out something that's important, which is that right-wing Christianity, conservative theology, the so-called rapture crowd, they're a very nihilistic group of people and dangerous for all sorts of reasons. But they've become associated with this notion of an apocalypse, which, as you point out, comes out of the Book of Revelation. But we should first of all remember that there are lots of theologians who will tell you the Book of Revelation is probably more accurately understood as a critique of the concentrated power of the Roman Empire, of the day in which the book was written. But whatever its original intent was, I think the idea of revelation or apocalypse is actually very useful. We should remember, first of all, that the word, or the words, revelation is Latin, apocalypse is Greek, they both mean the same thing, and they don't mean the end of the world. They mean a lifting of the veil, a coming into clarity, in a way of seeing what had previously been obscured. And I think the reason I like the term apocalypse is because a lot of people who are not connected to this particular reactionary theology do sense that the world in which we live, the high-energy, high-technology world defined by industrial capitalism, that world is not going to be with us forever. That is, we are drawing down the ecological capital of this planet at far beyond replacement levels, which means the system in which we live is going to come to an end at some point. We can't keep burning up fossil fuels and consuming the world's resources at the rate we do. So this notion of an apocalypse or a coming into clarity of the fact that this system is not going to go on forever, I think is very powerful. Certainly in the last 10 years or so that I've been doing public talks and writing, I've noticed more and more people are aware of that and are quite frankly afraid of it. I think people have a well-founded fear of where this system is taking us. So I was using the word apocalypse not to try to scare people, but in fact to appeal to what many people are afraid of just from looking at the data. And I don't just mean here climate change or global warming. If you look at the markers of the health of the planet, the health of the ecosystems that make our own lives possible, the news is pretty bad, not just about climate, but about water, about soil, about toxicity, about biodiversity, about energy. We're looking at some pretty grim realities here, and we need to start facing them in ways that the current political system simply cannot face. The current political system can barely even acknowledge the reality of the problems, let alone start thinking intelligently about solutions to those problems.
So the difference, though, I guess, between the right-wing Christian obsession with Armageddon, which is largely a fundraising tool for preachers, but it basically takes the position that we don't need to care about the environment because the world is going to end, couldn't be more opposed to the idea that there is a sort of growing sense in the zeitgeist and in our subconscious, if you will, that something is deeply wrong with the world and what we're doing to the world. But surely the challenge is not that the world will end if we continue on this current trajectory, but what we can all do to save the world. And doesn't that invite a greater form of patriotism than the 4th of July American patriotism? Doesn't it invite a kind of global patriotism to save our planet?
I agree. I actually think you're absolutely right that the most patriotic thing we can do, in a sense, is to transcend the conventional notions of patriotism. You know, going back to Christianity, and this is true of, you know, almost every faith system, that these are, you know, very complex historical phenomena that have lots of interpretations. So many Christians look at the text and tradition of their faith and see the call to stewardship, the call to social justice, the call to reform the way we treat each other and treat the earth, because this is our home. We're here and we're not going anywhere else. On the other hand, what I would call more pathological interpretations of Christianity really treat the earth like a throwaway planet, and therefore we don't have to be accountable for what we do. And you can choose which of those versions of reality you want, of course. But if we choose stewardship, if we choose social justice, if we take, I think, those deeper meanings of not only religious systems but political and ethical systems, if we take those seriously, then I don't see how one cannot become a kind of global citizen. And that term gets used in kind of silly ways often, but it's a powerful idea that, in fact, we are not simply citizens of a nation. That's where we get our passport. I have a U.S. passport, but I am more than a U.S. citizen. I have a connection to, an obligation to, all of my fellow citizens of the world. I think that's a profound shift that the United States has not been able to make yet. Others maybe around the world are a little closer, but in general, if we don't transcend this obsession with self-interest, whether it's identified as purely the self-interest of me, an individual, or the self-interest of me and my nation state, if we don't transcend that, the world does not have a very bright future. In fact, the human presence on the earth doesn't have much of a future at all.
Well, of course, Robert Jensen, again, professor in the School of Journalism at the University of Texas at Austin and board member of the Third Coast Activist Resource Center in Austin. And he has an article in the current issue of Yes Magazine, Get Apocalyptic, Why Radical is the New Normal. There's a difference between being a radical activist and a passive doomsday naysayer and just basically giving up, which I think, you know, a lot of people tend to feel that way. But there are recent examples to show that the human species is capable of reversing a trajectory towards mass global suicide. There was nothing more insane than the long, decades-long standoff between the Soviet Union and the United States in the Cold War, where the best that both these two superpowers were promising their own people was that we'll all be killed, but 20 minutes later, all the Russians will die too, or vice versa. And we lived with this insane system that was literally called mutually assured destruction, MAD, for a long time. And there were many, many close calls, a lot of which have not entirely been made public, some worse than the Cuba crisis. So it was the planet was literally held hostage to this insane doctrine for many decades. And then almost overnight, it all ended. And the possibility of the world ending very quickly because of incredible insanity on the part of a handful of paranoid politicians, that went away. So surely we can take some encouragement from that to suggest that maybe the end of the world is not inevitable in terms of global warming, and that we as a species are capable of getting ourselves out of these holes we dig for ourselves.
Well, certainly human history is full of examples of human beings turning away from, as you pointed, a kind of mass suicide. I mean, if you just think of the recent history of Europe, you know, Europeans considered themselves the pinnacle of civilization, and the French and the Germans and the British, you know, spent a good part of several centuries trying to destroy each other. So certainly history is full of the examples if we want to look at them. But I think what's most important now is asking questions in the right way. People often say, well, we've got to look at solutions. But of course, the question is solutions to what problems? A lot of times people mean by solutions, how can we keep this kind of industrial, high-energy, high-technology lifestyle going, even expand it to more and more people on the planet? Well, when people ask me, you know, how to solve that problem, I say, well, there is no solution, because the human species is not going to continue to live at this level of energy consumption indefinitely. But there are solutions if we're willing to open up and ask, how can we live at a lower level of energy consumption? Well, then the solutions become more creative and more possible. The problem today that I see is fundamentally the capitalist economy cannot come to terms with its own pathology, and therefore the reframing of these questions, not so much about how do we keep consuming, but how do we redefine what it means to live a good life and shift the way we've been thinking for the last couple of hundred years, that's certainly a problem that has a solution, but it's not going to be a solution that comes within traditional political and economic frameworks. We've got to think in very radical terms. Now, of course, radical is usually a dirty word in the United States. People who are radical are often told they're not realistic. But here's where I think one of the most important moves we can make is to recognize that the only realistic proposals for how to react to these problems are, in fact, radical proposals. That is, you know, business as usual within corporate capitalism, within this high-energy, high-technology world. Those are all losing strategies. And so to be so-called realistic is, in fact, to concede that we will destroy ourselves. So radical, when we talk about radical being the new normal, it's because, in fact, radical is the only realistic path to go down today. We've got to think in very different terms. Now, that's pretty intimidating in a world where, you know, literally billions of dollars a year are spent on advertising and public relations and marketing, what we should appropriately call the propaganda industries, all those billions of dollars to make sure that nobody ever asks or answers questions in this way. Yet here we are on the radio asking these kinds of questions. So this conversation in a way sort of obviously proves that we can go forward. And the question is, how do we create movements, institutions, networks of people that see the world this way, are willing to continue this conversation? And here, you know, I live in Austin, Texas, and do a lot of local organizing. We have a very vibrant progressive community center we established in the last 5 years. We've got grassroots organizing groups concerned with economic justice, with immigrant rights, with gender and racial justice. They're going forward. We've got gardening groups. We've got people concerned with sustainable agriculture. You know, none of that is in and of itself the solution. No one group has the answer. But it's in this work that we all do, even against the odds, that the potential emerges. And I don't know about anybody else, but I'm 55 years old, and it's enough to get me out of bed every morning and committing a fair amount of my own time, energy, and money to this kind of organizing, just because I know that it's in that organizing that we create new potential. I don't have to have the answers to motivate myself to get involved. That organizing I'm talking about is in and of itself worth doing. the connections, the human relationships formed out of it are in and of themselves worth the effort. But beyond that, we're creating the possibility of real change. But that only happens when one is willing to get radical, in my opinion.
Well, just in closing then, Robert Jensen, on this 4th of July, it's not as if there aren't any models in the DNA of this country. I mean, after all, you know, arguably, I was born in Australia, and therefore we're all descended from convicts. And whenever anybody sort of mentions that derisively, I always say, well, you know, I'm descended from convicts, and you here in America are descended from religious fanatics. But there are antecedents here that are very somewhat similar. I thought of it when you were talking about a new lifestyle, less materialistic, more earth-friendly, and to get off the capitalist trap that we're on of depleting resources and plundering the planet and consuming. The Quakers, for example, preached humility, frugality, hard work, connections to nature, all of those things. I mean, so
absolutely. You know, yeah. There have been, you know, all kinds of communities in the history of the United States that have tried to create a just and sustainable future. Now, no one of them is perfect from my point of view. Take the Amish, for instance, who are often derided as being out of step with the modern world. And there are parts of Amish life I don't endorse. I don't particularly like their conception of gender relations. But they're based on communities, and they're based on a model of agriculture that's far more sustainable than the high-energy agribusiness model of the contemporary United States. Does that mean the Amish are the way we should all live? No. But look at political movements on the left. They did take up questions about social justice, about equality. There were problems with the way they organized. Does that mean we throw out those models? Well, we don't necessarily have to replicate any one of these places where we see ways that people have sustained decent human values. We have to look at the past, not to repeat it, but to give us indications, as you're pointing out, of the kind of best of our traditions, and fashion a future that I think no one knows how to describe. The one thing I'm pretty confident of is that the future, and I'm not talking about science fiction, I'm talking about a decade, two decades down the road, is probably not going to look a lot like the world we live in today. There's going to be both physical, ecological, and social, political dislocations that we're going to have to cope with. And the only thing I know to do is to build those relationships, those networks, those institutions on the ground, at the grassroots level, where people are committed to each other, committed to social justice. It's about the one-on-one relationships we make in this work, and it's about the values that animate the work. And I think that, you know, when we talk about ecological sustainability and social justice, we encompass the best of our traditions. When we talk about grassroots groups that build power from below to try and affect the centers of power in Washington and New York, there's a tradition of that. I think we have all the tools we need. It's just a question of making that commitment. And maybe that's what we should be doing on this 4th of July, is making a commitment not to, as you're pointing out at the beginning of the show, empty notions of patriotism, but commitments to the real values of solidarity, of equality, and the inherent dignity of all people. That's where the action is, and all over the country and all over the world, in fact, at the grassroots, people are, in fact, doing that.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us today, Robert Jensen.
Great to be with you. Thanks, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Robert Jensen, a professor in the School of Journalism at the University of Texas at Austin and a board member of the Third Coast Activist Resource Center in Austin. He's the author of All My Bones Shake, Seeking a Progressive Path to the Prophetic Voice, Citizens of the Empire, The Struggle to Claim Our Humanity, Writing Dissent, Taking Radical Ideas from the Margins to the Mainstream, and Arguing for Our Lives, A User's Guide to Constructive Dialogue. He has an article in the summer issue of Yes Magazine, Get Apocalyptic, Why Radical is the New Normal. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking with George Lakoff about whether qualities other than militarism, chauvinism, and jingoism can be celebrated on the 4th of July.
Your neck. Team, my team reporters battle Trump.